Welcome to the April New England Fishery Management Council meeting. A few of the normal housekeeping items. Cell phones, please go on to silence. We will try and take a break every 90 minutes. I will ask any council members, are there any additions or changes to the agenda? Okay, seeing none, we will get right into the reports section. Starts off with my report. I think everybody probably saw that you have at your seat a copy of Robert's Rules. Rodney said it was a little late for him, but we have been trying to schedule someone to come and give a presentation on meeting management and Robert's Rules of Orders, just because of our agenda schedule and other presenter schedule. We haven't been able to do it yet. We will still continue to try and do that, so we decided to give everybody a copy of this to read through in their spare time. There'll be a pop quiz on this tomorrow sometime. Under Council Chair, I'm going to give a quick rundown on the last Executive Committee meeting, which was towards the end of February. This is under Correspondence and Reports under Tab 1. The first item, we discussed the timelines and management actions. The one thing I want to note on this is, and we've discussed this before, but we do now have the timelines on our website. It's under the Council Actions tab, and as things get updated or changed on the timelines, it's indicated with the date of when that was updated. Item two was to, we just had a discussion on revisiting priorities and looking at the work plan, primarily as it relates to the sturgeon listing. There will be that discussion as at 11 o'clock today, so I'm not going to cover it here. We discussed Amendment 18, and essentially the committee agreed to extend the comment period for Amendment 18 by 60 days. The item four was a discussion on the draft policy concerning AP chairs attending the Oversight Committee meetings. Paul will go over that discussion at the 115 item today. Five was the outstanding outreach items in response to the Touchstone, or as people like to call it, the PATE report, and to approve changes to the PDT policy. Essentially, the change would allow the Executive Committee to approve industry-funded and non-governmental organization scientists for the PDT on a case-by-case basis. The committee also looked at what actions had been taken and had a discussion concerning an ABC risk policy workshop, and we have had an offer from the Fisheries Forum to work with us concerning that. We have formed a committee. The committee has met, and the committee is just looking at putting together this workshop, and it looks like it's likely to be in the early part of 2013. There was a discussion concerning an MOU with the Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service about seabirds. Staff was supposed to craft some comments for the council on this. and their response to the executive committee was that they felt they didn't have the expertise to make those comments, and it was agreed that the service should work directly with Fish and Wildlife to provide some recommendations on that. Four was the possible council membership on the Northeast Regional Ocean Commission. The issue that we dealt with there was that whoever that appointee was had to be a federal, state, or local government official. It was requested that I see if I could convince my town selectman to become dog catcher. I was not successful in attempting to do that. And so we had to go in another direction. We asked if Doug Grout would represent the council on NROC, and he has discussed that and has accepted it. The next item, which was the discussion on the work plans on the stock structure and stock assessment for Gulf of Maine cod, that will be part of the Groundfish Committee discussion coming up. The next part of that was the SSC looking at some of the Gulf of Maine cod issues. And again, that report will be Wednesday at 10:15. The next item also blends into the first one concerning the Groundfish Committee report and the Gulf of Maine cod. The committee discussed the rockhopper and roller gear letter that we received from the National Marine Fisheries Service that was remanded to the Groundfish Committee, and that will be part of, again, their presentation coming up on Wednesday. And we looked at the meeting schedule, which will be in tab one. One other item is this afternoon at 4:15. It is on our agenda. There is the first of the listening sessions. All of the council members are welcome to come to that. I will be there. I think Dan is going to be there, George. But our hope there is that we can open up to, you know, any questions and discussion items that people want. It will be held in this room, and I would have to rely on Pat for what the actual format will be. But maybe Dan and I get to sit at the center table there and receive all the questions. But Paul, do you have a comment on that?
If I'm not mistaken, Pat's here, but I think it's part of the whole council process. So in other words, the council members stay here, and that as questions come in, you may be able to direct a question, a response to either a council member or a staff. But Pat, am I correct in saying that this is part of the council process? It isn't just for Rip and for Dan. The whole council will be here, and right.
Are there any questions on my report? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Rip, number five in your report that relates to the plan development team members, and that the executive committee will, on a case-by-case basis, approve industry-funded and non-governmental organization scientists. Have you taken that a step further regarding describing, providing for yourselves, the executive committee, the process that you would use, criteria you would use to guide your decisions? Case by case basis is fine, but still, for your benefit and the benefit of future executive committees, what have you laid down regarding the objectives and rules of the road?
We will get at the 115 item today, we will get those details from Paul. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question about number six. I did see where the correspondence went back to Sam Rauch regarding the MOU and Seabirds, and thinking that we may have seen something prior come into the council, and I missed it. Just forgetting what the background was and what they were asking of the council to begin with, and I kind of looked and I couldn't find it. So any additional information there that would help?
I might be able to help a little bit. As far as I know, we're still in the stage of it being a draft memorandum of understanding with Department of Interior, and the council is just being asked to comment on that draft. So there's nothing formally in place as far as I know. I don't think it's been signed yet. I had given the council a little briefing on that when it first came out, and this was just a follow-up to get the council staff's comments back to the agency.
So if you provided us a briefing at what council meeting, so I can go back and look at that. I'm just not remembering the details of the MOU and what the purpose of having it was at this stage. And I can look it up myself if I just know where to go.
I believe it was in January, at the January council meeting.
Chris?
I believe the MOU was a result of an executive order that was actually 2 or 3 years old. And the two agencies, Fish and Wildlife and the Fisheries Service, were following through on that. Our comments were specifically that on staff, we don't have the expertise to deal with bird issues. And so we requested that when this goes forward, that the lack of expertise on the council staff be recognized, and that specific suggestions on mitigating impacts on seabirds be provided in such a form that we could come to the council as options that are completed rather than have our staff do the work on them. Talking with the regional office staff, they had similar feelings in terms of the lack of resources at this time to deal with bird issues. So I believe that they would be commenting somewhat along the same lines.
So I guess that was kind of some of the information I was looking for. Do we have some new mandate to mitigate interactions with seabirds? Seabirds are not bycatch under Magnuson, and I know that there are, you know, international treaties on birds and all these kinds of things. I understand that, but are we now going to be required to consider mitigation measures and FMPs for seabirds?
To be honest, my memory is a little fuzzy on the details, but the executive order that Chris was referring to, I think, actually went back to like 2002. So it's not a new thing. It's just taken the two agencies a while to address this. And I think it had to do with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And it would call for the councils to consider the impacts of seabirds among the other kinds of impacts they examine when they do fishery management action, same way you would with mammals or sea turtles or other things. But beyond that, I'd have to go back and look at the actual executive order and MOU, and I don't have that with me.
So if our response to this at this point is that we don't have the expertise at the council level to engage on seabirds, the alternative is we let somebody else decide what the alternatives would be that we consider? Is that what we're suggesting?
Yes. I met with the Fish and Wildlife Regional Office earlier this month, and we began the conversation about how to consult with and draw upon their expertise to brief the council or to provide that consultative service kind of outside of our normal process. We agreed to work on it as the MOU is signed and becomes our guiding document. So we haven't worked out exactly how it will work or how it will function, but they've agreed to provide the service.
So, I mean, certainly I do agree that we don't have expertise in seabirds. I mean, we've not had to deal with that in the past. Just a little uncomfortable about another federal agency in having it. It's a little hard to figure out with all the different actions that we have that they're going to be able to step forward and provide us alternatives, and then to what extent do we have the ability to veer from that. It's a very different process, and we may not like it.
Any other questions or comments on my report? Okay, Executive Director Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the last several months, we've lost a number of staff people. Sarah Potsky left us for Hawaii. Jessica Megley left. Talia recently left, and just this last week, Ann Hawkins gave her resignation. So we lost four people. And over the last 6 months, we have been going out and soliciting to hire two, maybe three, and with some additional resignations, we've now hired four people. All these four people are on two-year contracts depending on our 2013 budget. Right now, the early indications are our budget is going to be 14% less than what it is now. And we were level funded this year, which was good news. So we've hired four people. I'm delighted with who we brought aboard, and I'm going to introduce them to you. There's two of them that I'll introduce now. The first one is Rachel Neal, if you'll stand up, Rachel, so everyone can get a know who you are. And Rachel has got a Bachelor of Science in Biology from UNH. She's also done her Master's at the University of Denver in Environmental Policy. She's recently worked for NIMS as a contractor, and she spent 3.5 years in the Air Force as an officer, and she was a missileer. She had her finger on the button. So one of the first orders of counsel I gave her is, we don't need to push any buttons here at the council. So anyway, welcome aboard, Rachel. Thank you. I'd also like to introduce David Thomas. David comes to us from a recent graduate from Virginia Tech. He's a very technical background, good with numbers, data, and analytical tools, so he should help us all out. He was a research assistant in Arlington, Virginia, since graduation last year. He's got a BS in biology from Virginia Tech and a minor in astronomy. So we expect stellar things from David. Welcome, David. And I'll introduce the other two staff later on today. Thank you. Oh, I have a couple other things. Okay. So the IG auditors were with us this week. They spent the first part of the week with National Marine Fisheries Service, and then on Wednesday, Thursday, they spent days with us, those 2 days with us. Two folks from the Department of Commerce IG auditor's office. They spoke with me, Chris, Tom, our admin officer, our economist, and social impact. It appears from the questions asked, they were looking at how we interact with NIMS, how we interact with the public, and how well we do with social impact assessments and things like that. So they've moved on from us down to the Gulf Council. They've already been to the Pacific Council. There was no indication when they also interviewed Rip and Jim. I forgot to mention that. So there was no indication of when they'd be back. I did, however, believe that there was more to do, so I expect we'll hear from them in the future as well. The NRCC is meeting May 21st and 22nd. So if you have any agenda items you'd like the chair and vice chair and myself to bring up to the NRCC, please get them to me as soon as you can. We're calling for agenda items now. One of the biggest things that we're going to be talking about is the timing of when we get assessments and when we do our management actions, what type of assessments we need. The whole assessment management process has been kind of, I think Bill will agree, has been thrown out of whack a little bit with the Gulf of Maine COD and Georges Bank COD and all these other assessments. So we need to really get back on a planning schedule with our assessments. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Okay, we will move along to the acting regional administrator.
And his designee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to give my usual report, and at the end of that, we will have an update on the SBRM activity from Doug Potts and my staff. Under multi-species, we published a final rule for our secretarial amendment for the small mesh multi-species, that's whitings and hakes, on March 30th. It will become effective May 1. And if you recall, this puts in place essentially stopgap measures to satisfy the ACL and AM requirements while the council completes its development of Amendment 19, which is on this agenda as well. And at such time that that's approved and implemented, that will supersede most, if not all, of the secretarial measures. On sectors, we have had 19 sectors submitting operations plans and contracts for fishing year 2012. We published a proposed rule for those contracts and their requested exemptions on February 15th. Comment period ended March 1. Final rules under review, and we expect to have that implemented by May 1. I'm sure you're all aware of the Gulf of Maine COD interim action that we published on April 3rd that was so much a part of the January council meeting's agenda. Those measures will become effective May 1 as well and implement an ACL of 6,700 metric tons and allow a carryover of 10% of unused fishing year 2011 ACEs for the sectors with carryover. Groundfish Framework 47, those are the specifications for the upcoming fishing year. We published a proposed rule for that on March 27th. Comment period closed April 11th. And here, too, we have a final rule that's in the final stages of clearance, and we hope to have that in place May 1 as well. Amendment 17 to Groundfish, the Permit Banks rule, was approved on March 8th, and the final rule implementing those approved measures was published on March 23rd. This amends the FMP to explicitly define and facilitate the effective operation of state-operated permit banks. You may also remember from the January meeting, we had a discussion of the accountability measures for the recreational fishery for Gulf of Maine haddock. Based on the MRFS data, we had determined that the 2010 fishing year Gulf of Maine haddock recreational ACL had been exceeded, and on January 6th had published a notice to put in place accountability measures for that stock. However, when we got the new MRIP data, it showed that that stock had actually not exceeded its ACL, and we, partially at the urging of the council, have published a final rule on April 20th, removed those accountability measures as being unnecessary, and reinstituted the recreational measures previously in place, which was no bag limit and 18-inch minimum fish size. Under Days at Sea Leasing Program, the usual update, total leases processed, this is through April 16th, total leases processed for the common pool was 30. For sectors, it was 347. The total leases approved was 22 for the common pool and 269 for sectors. The total days at sea leased for common pool was 342 and for sectors 7,598. Average cost of days at sea leased for the common pool was $115.62 and for sectors $90.10. Regarding sector ACE transfers, as of April 16th, we have had a total of 1,279 ACE transfers for a total of £16,990,548. The proposed rule for the 2012 spiny dogfish specifications were published on March 19th, and the comment period closed on April 18th. Final rule for that is currently under development. We proposed what the council had recommended to us, which was 35.694 million pound ACL and a 3,000 pound trip limit. Under Atlantic Sea Scallops, Framework Adjustment 23 was finalized through a final rule published on April 6, 2012, and will become effective May 7th. This is the one that implements measures to minimize impacts on sea turtles, improves the accountability measures for yellowtail flounder, adjusts the Northern Gulf of Maine management program, and modifies the scallop vessel monitoring system trip notification procedures. Under skates, the proposed rule for the 2012-2013 skate specifications published on February 22nd, comment period closed March 23rd. A final rule is under development. We're expecting that May file this week, and we expect to have that effective May 1. And that completes my report. Thank you.
Are there questions for George? Dave?
Thank you, Rip. George, recently fishermen received their 2012 PSC letters, and they didn't include Gulf of Maine cod, and I assume that's because you can't calculate that till you figure out exactly what the carryover is. But really, for most of us, it's kind of like going into an ice cream shop and finding out how many sprinkles you got without finding out how much ice cream you can put it on. So my question is, when do you think we'll find out how much cod we can catch?
Upon publication of Framework 47, which we hope will be within a week, we'll be issuing those allocation letters.
So it's okay. So it's tied to Framework 47. It's not tied to the carryover?
And the sector rule. Yeah. And both of those hopefully will be published at the same time or
and
very close to it.
Then you would guess, what, maybe a couple of weeks after that to actually get those letters out?
Or? I would think so. My ground fish staff will be here tomorrow, and I'm sure we can get some detail from them when they're here if you want to talk to them.
Okay. No, that would be good because a lot of fishermen can't leave the pier till they know how much cod they got. So thank you.
Any other questions for George? David.
Yeah, George, regarding the service's action on Atlantic sturgeon, are you going to elaborate tomorrow when we have our discussions regarding protected species? I know tomorrow sturgeon is on the agenda. I assume that there'll also be an opportunity for us to get into more depth regarding the decisions the service made on gill netting October-November closure due to the bycatch of porpoise. So is that when you might provide more detail?
Yes. The agenda item will include both the presentation on Atlantic sturgeon and opportunity to respond to any questions you may have, as well as the harbor porpoise announcement of last week.
Thanks, Dan.
Anyone else? Okay.
Good morning. I'm the unfamiliar face here at the table, and I wanted to reintroduce myself to the council and to others. I'm Dan Morris, and I'm still the acting regional administrator. I still have no news to announce on the appointment of a new regional administrator. I haven't heard a peep. So I don't know whether I'll be in this seat for two more weeks or two more months or some other period. So I wanted to make sure that you know who I am and how to reach me. We will continue to rely on George Darcy's expertise and experience to provide the council and the public expert continuous service from the agency and representation here at the table. And so I would expect and hope that you will continue to look to George as that expert and as the go-to person for your questions. I of course take responsibility for the decisions of the regional office, and so I fully expect to be pulled into those conversations frequently. I would like to add a couple of points to George's report. We did enjoy a visit last week from the Inspector General's office. They actually came back on Friday. We gave them an awful lot of materials that they had requested, administrative records from maybe a dozen actions. They spent a lot of their time just reading and asking for clarification in the location of certain things. Paul mentioned the socioeconomic indicators and analysis in the various documents. There was also quite a few questions about transparency of process and opportunities for public involvement. Another item that I just want to mention to you, you know, Paul mentioned the council's budget and how it's affecting or how it may affect priorities in the future and responsiveness in the future. And we're struggling with the same thing. We have about 9 or 10 positions that remain unfilled in the regional office and no hope of filling them in 2013. We're seeking out greater efficiency wherever we can and trying to take programmatic approaches to some of our activities that provide us more bang for the buck. But we're nearing a point where we're having to do kind of operational triage, and we'll be working closely with the council and through the NRCC to really look at our priorities and how they get adjusted in the remainder of this year in 2013 with reduced staffing. The staffing is affecting our Sustainable Fisheries Division with, I think, 4 of the positions are empty right now. Our habitat program has taken a real big hit. Protective resources is in slightly better shape. I can provide more details if anyone is interested, but I just wanted you to know that we're also struggling to keep up with the great amount of information and needs that are coming to us. So thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dan. Does anybody have any questions for Dan? Laura?
I just was curious what your thoughts were on the announcement from the Senate Appropriations Committee regarding the consolidation of your office to Silver Spring.
The consolidation of our office, rather than the removal of our office from Gloucester. It is very, very early in the 2013 budget process. This was a Senate subcommittee that is issuing this report, and we're doing everything we can to provide full information about the services that our office provides and distribution of the fishery and participants. So I'm really not permitted to say any more than that, just that it's really early in the process and, you know, we'll see where it goes. We're not actively worried.
Anyone else? Okay, so we'll move into the SBRM. Vito, you have a comment, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Vito Calamo, and I'm one of the regional directors for United States Senator Scott Brown, and I am his fisheries expert for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And Dan, this is on that subject. We fully plan to stand behind you as far as keeping the NOAA building, the NIMS building open at Blackburn Industrial Park. We have no desire to change the National Marine Fisheries Service other than your leader, and that's public knowledge, but you can count us for support if needed to keep that facility open. It's an important facility, And on a personal note, I've always been behind the National Marine Fisheries Service. I've disagreed with them from time to time. And George can tell you that I have, publicly and privately. But we are fully supportive of the establishment there. And if there's anything I can do, we can do with the senator, please let us know. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vito. Anyone else? Okay, we will move into SBRM.
Thank you. Just to be clear, I'm discussing the SBRM omnibus amendment actions, and as far as coverage levels for this year, I think Jim is addressing at some other time, or he would take questions on that if there's any question. I'm Doug Potts from the regional office. As probably all know, the 2007 SBRM omnibus amendment was challenged right after it was implemented. Initially, the U.S. District Court supported the amendment. However, last summer, the Court of Appeals overruled that and vacated the amendment, remanding it back to the agency for further action. The appeals court's decision hinged on finding fault with one of the seven components of the SBRM amendment, specifically the prioritization process. They felt that the court ruled that it left too much discretion on the part of the agency to determine when an external operating constraint, primarily funding, prohibited the effective implementation of the 30% CV performance standard. They also found that the prioritization process gave too much latitude to the agency to determine what the final coverage levels would be when that prioritization process was triggered. Following the ruling from the court, the NRCC met last fall's meeting and established or determined that a new FMAT, or Fishery Management Action Team, would be established to develop a new SBRM omnibus amendment to address these concerns. At that time, the NRCC directed this FMAT or gave guidance that they should be targeted at just the prioritization process that was found to be lacking by the court and any other. At the same time, last year there was a three-year review of the SBRM that was part of the original amendment, although the final report was made moot by the fact that the amendment had been vacated. Much of the analysis was done, and there were some suggestions that had come out of that FMAT group to improve the process in the future. So the NRCC had asked the FMAT to, once established, to not only address the prioritization process, but any of those improvements that could be reasonably included in the new action. The FMAT was formed December, January of this year. We've met. So far, we've trying to address specifically determining triggers that leave out the discretion on the part of the agency to determine when funding is lacking. We are also working on those reactions to develop a more formulaic method of determining coverage levels when we cannot fully fund the 30% CV across fleets. That is ongoing, and we're also starting to address a couple of the three-year review suggestions that had come out. Some of these may be able to be included. Some are likely to have too much time and analysis necessary in order to really fit in the time allotted. At this time, there was a handout that I think went around today. I'm sorry you didn't get it beforehand. It just has a brief background on this action, members of the FMAT, and on the back is what is currently the proposed schedule coming out of the FMAT. Our target is to have final implementation of the new amendment for May 1st of 2013, so for next fishing year, the following fishing year. In order to hit that, it sort of lays out that there are a few other things we need to hit, and it starts actually with having a list of alternatives by the next council meeting in June for both councils. There would then be a draft amendment that we could give, hopefully, at the August Mid-Atlantic meeting, September New England meeting, having a final action that then could be approved hopefully at the October and November meetings, and then go into rulemaking process for the May 1st deadline. excuse me. I think that's mostly there was a discussion. This presentation was given to the Mid-Atlantic Council 2 weeks ago. At that time, they opted against forming a special committee to address this and wanted to take recommendations coming out of the FMET directly to the council. I think that would be the discussion this council, whether this council also wanted to establish wanted to choose to set up a committee in this case or to treat it directly from the council, from the FMET. I think that's the update where we are right now. Are there any questions I can take, or if Gene wanted to make a comment about the law or anything?
Terry. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question actually might be somewhat related to the next agenda item on priorities and staff workload. I notice on the proposed schedule, it's fairly aggressive, and I also notice that Tom Neese is our designated staff member. He's a one-man army. With all that we have going on in the world of groundfish, I'm concerned that we don't spread them too thin.
Well, Tom just, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Tom just took that first meeting because Talia had left us. Talia was designated to be the SBRM. But again, we can discuss it now or after when we talk priorities, but we had initially thought of establishing a committee with a staff member to look at SBRM, but since it is a very singular focus and we've got a number of other priorities, I think the alternative to just have an FMAT and bring recommendations to the council is a good one, which will need council approval, and that's the way the MID went. So I think that to follow on and not have a joint committee is probably the best way to do
it. Terry, follow up? Yeah, just a quick follow up. I'm comfortable with the second approach and also comfortable with deferring the further discussion until the next agenda item.
Mary Beth and Dave Gaisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also am comfortable with the approach. Just thinking back to the development of the amendment, we didn't have a committee. It was really the agency was the lead. And I think that's fine, particularly in this case where it's going to be a fairly singular focus. But one criticism I had heard about the process we had previously was that the public had difficulty sort of engaging in it. So where it's not a council committee, we tend not to put those things on our website, but I think if the FMAT, when they meet, can inform the councils, and so the councils can put that on their website and the public's informed and can attend, the details really happen at the FMAT, and if people are interested, that's where the meeting they need to be going to and listening to. I think that would be helpful.
Thank you for that. Dave Gaisel.
Yeah, my question's for Doug. Having read over this sheet and what you said here, to me, the problem with this turns out to be the 30% CV. Now that the council's had some experience with this, we are realizing how much coverage that results in some fisheries that have numerous stratas and employ different cod ends and things like that at different times of the year. So my question or my comment would be that would be the first thing I'd look at is changing the CV to something that will allow you to have levels of coverage more in line with funding. I think we're ending up with too many observers and too many, you know, small strata getting relatively little amounts of information on small amounts of fish that may not be necessary. So I would hope that as part of this examination you would consider changing that coefficient of variance, at least for a good portion of the fisheries.
Do you want to?
George.
Yeah, that is going to be beyond the scope of this particular action. We have to be very, very surgical in this one to satisfy the requirement of the court as quickly as possible and to not use too much staff time. But we recognize, too, that there are some other issues that may be one. Other things that have come up as this has been used that may need to be looked at in the future. But it wouldn't be through this one because we really need to keep this slim and fast.
Dave Pierce.
Yeah, Doug, I noticed from the sheet that you referenced that the three-year review occurred and there are some specific proposals for changes. as a consequence of that review, and one is to add new fleets that have arisen since the development of the 2007 SBRM amendment. Can I assume that by new fleet that also means sector management? In other words, now we have groundfish sectors. In a way, each one is a separate fleet that has to be sampled in a certain way. So can I assume that out of this three-year review, there will be a greater, a more in-depth look as to how to cover the sectors themselves in terms of percent coverage and how they're covered?
I think actually out of the SBRM, a lot of the fleets in an SBRM sense are more of a gear, time, area, or fishery combination. And I think this refers more to like the development of the rule trawl had separated trawls that were not used at the time 2007 came out. Coverage for sector level, I don't know if that's separate from the SBRM, this actual bycatch under the FMP versus the monitoring coverage levels that are being established for sectors, if that makes sense.
Okay. I know maybe 6 months ago, maybe a year ago, time flies, I had asked the question of the Senate's representative regarding the SBRM and how sectors were going to be covered, how the decisions would be made to apportion available samplers to the individual sectors. And I was told at the time that it was sort of a work in progress and they'd figure it out eventually. So I'm assuming it's still germane to the SBRM, and if it is, I hope that that further work will be done on this so the Council can be advised as to how sea sampling effort will be distributed amongst all of the individual fleets that I define as specific sector membership.
Anyone else? Jim.
Thank you. I'd just like to add a little bit to what Dave Pierce was just bringing up. And the reason why it was referred to as a work in progress, referring how it would be applied to sectors, is that the sectors had been implemented very recently. And the goal of the observer coverage is to account for a certain percentage of the mortality in the different fish due to discards. And in order to allocate things properly, as scientists, one needs data in order to see from your data to allocate things in the future appropriately. So the reason it was referred to as a work in progress is we were looking for more information, at least from a full year of sector implementation, to try to make adjustments. So the goal is to account for percentages of the mortality and to allocate whatever resources we have efficiently.
Anyone else? Thank you, Doug. Okay, we will move on to General Counsel. Keen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had on March 9th, the D.C. District Court filed its opinion decision in the Flaherty versus NOAA lawsuit, which challenged Amendment 4 to the herring fishery. The plaintiffs challenged on a number of issues involving the Magnuson-Stevens Act, National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, and the Administrative Procedure Act, APA. With respect to the Magnuson-Stevens Act challenges, the plaintiffs challenged the approval of Amendment 4 without naming river herring and shad as a stock in the fishery. They challenged the approvability of the amendment because it did not comply with National Standard 9, which requires minimization of bycatch to the extent practicable in FMPs. They also challenged the ABCs, the ACLs, the AMs that were established in the amendment. And they challenged the adequacy of the environmental assessment and its conclusion that there was a finding of no significant impact. Now, the court granted
in part the plaintiff's claims and denied it in part, or granted the government's cross motions for summary judgment in this case. In other words, the court found on some issues in favor of the plaintiff and on other issues in favor of the government defendants. Specifically, the court found that NOAA NEMPS did not satisfy the obligation to independently determine whether the council's designation of stocks in the fishery complied with the Madison-Stevens Act. Court didn't actually say that river herring should have been a stock in the fishery. Rather, they found that National Marine Fisheries Service did not adequately consider this issue in its review of Amendment 4. The court also found that NIMS did not adequately consider whether Amendment 4 complies with National Standard 9. Again, the court was looking at whether the analysis was sufficient to show that NIMS had made a valid decision that it did that Amendment 4 did satisfy National Standard 9, the bycatch minimization requirements. with respect to upholding the government's position, the court upheld the annual catch limits, the accountability and accountability measures of the amendment. Under the NEPA claims, the court found that NIMS failed to consider the environmental impacts of alternatives to the proposed ABC control rule and the accountability measures. Now, the court punted on the remedy. In other words, the court did not take any specific action as to what should be done by the agency with respect to these findings that went against the agency. Instead, the court asked both parties to file briefs as to what the appropriate remedy should be. And implicit in this kind of order is that the two parties should try to get together to see if they can come up with a jointly agreed to and proposed remedy measures. There's been a couple of this is supposed to have been filed, I think, on March 26th, the briefs to the court as to remedy. There's been one or two extensions on that, and currently we both parties have filed for a motion to extend until May 4th the date for submitting the briefs on the remedy. As of yesterday, the judge has not yet ruled on that request for another extension. The agency is basically arguing, one of the things it's arguing with respect to remedy that's mentioned in the decision is that the case should be remanded back to the agency and to the council to consider the opinion of the court and address that accordingly. Just two other comments about ongoing litigation. As you know, in the challenge to Amendment 16 to the Groundfish FNP, which the government won on all counts at the district court level, there's been appeals filed by various groups of plaintiffs. The plaintiffs and the governments have filed their briefs. Just recently, the Georgia's Bank Cod Fixed Gear Sector requested that they be able to file an amicus or friend of the court brief in support of the government. Most of the appellants opposed that, but the court granted permission to this group to file an amicus brief and said that the plaintiffs could respond to it in no more than 8 pages. So that brief has been filed, and I believe we're still awaiting the responses from the appellants in that case. So once all of the briefs have been filed, the court will consider whether it wants to have oral arguments, and we'll set up a schedule for that and then make a decision after the oral arguments, if there are any, are completed. In respect to the other challenge to Amendment 16 brought by Oceana on grounds that the conservation measures in Amendment 16 were not sufficient to certain degrees to satisfy Madison-Stevens Act, in particular
that the that there were no adequate accountability measures for the stocks that were not allocated to the various sectors. As you know, we the government lost on that issue. The court found that the accountability measures for these particular stocks, or six of them, did not have adequate reactive accountability measures. In other words, there weren't accountability measures that were triggered if an ACL was exceeded. The court recognized that there's some utility, some benefit to having what we call prospective accountability measures, such as zero possession limits, but that those don't satisfy the need to have some sort of accountability measures if an ACL is exceeded. So Framework 47 was supposed to address this issue, and we put in the preamble to the rule that we would be considering comments on this, and that we will in our decision to approve or disapprove Framework 47, we'll be concluding or making determinations as to whether the accountability measures that were included in Framework 47, particularly for these six stocks, are sufficient to meet the Madison-Stevens Act requirements and to satisfy the court's finding in the case. Now, this sort of is, well, both parties in this case have filed intentions or motions for appealing the decision. It doesn't necessarily mean that the appeal will go forward, but in order to preserve the opportunity for the appeal, at least on the government side, the motion for appeal, a motion for appeal was filed, so that if to give the Department of Justice adequate time to see whether it wanted to appeal the merits of this case. So technically, this case is on has been set up for an appeal, but we'll have to stay tuned to see if the appeal goes forward. So that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm particularly concerned about the river herring. The implications of determining river herring and shad as part of the management unit are huge. Setting ACLs, setting ABC, setting sub-ACLs by state, allocating, it's just huge. And, you know, it appears to me that the elements in the suit that were not found in favor of the government seem like, in my opinion, we went, you know, setting ABC, setting ACL. We went through very deliberate process over the years to set those for herring. And Amendment 5 is considering measures for minimizing the river herring bycatch, not 4. So it just seems to me that you know, I hate to say it, but it doesn't feel like it was defended very well. And to remand it back to the council, I would recommend to the council that we say, thank you for remanding it, but we believe we did set our ABCs well and ACLs, and we're going to consider river herring measures for bycatch, but we certainly don't want to manage it because it's managed by the states. So just to remand it without the NIMS or the courts deciding what to do after we've done all this work on it seems kind of like a cop-out to me, Gene.
Well, we made the arguments you mentioned to the court. The court specifically said it's not adequate to delay some of these decisions until Amendment 5. We made all the arguments. I'm not sure what you mean that you don't want a remand, that you'd rather have a specific order by the court as to what to do. I mean, maybe I need clarification on what you're asking.
Well, the big issue is, do we consider river herring and shad as part of the stock in the fishery?
which to me would mean set a huge precedent, and it would say we set ABCs, ACLs, and we manage river herring. Okay? Now, that's managed by the states as well as shad. So that's a huge implication to say that a state-managed fishery or a federal-managed fishery, which is ASMFC, is now going to be, it's just convoluted. Well, and, you know, it doesn't seem right that we should add stocks to the fishery that really aren't, they're managed by another entity.
Well, the court didn't say you have to add them. The court just said there wasn't justification as to why they weren't added. There wasn't sufficient justification. So theoretically, if this is remanded, remember there hasn't been a decision on the remedy here. The council, and if the agency agrees, can make a case and a record more completely as to why river herring, shad should not be a stock in the fishery. I mean, I'm just saying theoretically that it would still be an option if it is remanded and the court allows additional consideration of this issue. I think it's premature to say that what the conclusions would be if there is a remand with respect to this particular issue. There's going to be very strong arguments from the other side that the river herring and shad should be considered a stock in the fishery for whatever reasons they come up with. There's some guidance in the National Standard 7 about what determines whether a stock should be part of a fishery or not. So this debate, this analysis will have to take place. Now, there will be a question of timing, whether there will be a question as to whether Amendment 5 has to consider this issue. I mean, I understand it's already well down the road and may not be appropriate to open that up again. But all of these things have to be considered. And until we get a specific remedy from the court, it's, you know, really can't speculate as to exactly what the agency or NIMS will have to do with regard to this finding.
Do you have any sense of when we might get that decision from the court?
Well,
obviously the clock right. is ticking on Amendment 5.
If we get if we get the extension for May 4th, I would hope it would be. I mean, it's very hard to predict when courts will make decisions, but I think this will be a fairly narrow decision on the part of the court. The court recognizes that the remedy has to be issued as soon as possible. So hopefully it would be a matter of, a couple of weeks at most, but I really don't know after May 1st when the court would make a final decision as to remedy.
Mary Beth.
Thank you. I mean, I think, you know, hopefully we'll have more information in June, and it certainly will impact, could possibly impact Amendment 5 and or the specification package that we're going to be developing later in the year. And I just did have one question. The court found that the agency didn't fully consider National Standard 9 to minimize bycatch. And as my recollection is that we have no measures in Amendment 4, which implemented the new Magnuson requirements that consider bycatch in any way. And I'm wondering, did we have something in the goals and objectives that referenced bycatch and then did not address bycatch in any of the measures? Is that a correct?
I don't know off the top of my head. I actually did not. It was another attorney in my office that did this lawsuit. And I just don't know that. I don't remember seeing that in the opinion that was a problem. But I don't know off the top of my head whether that was an objective or not in Amendment 4.
And I just raised that because, I mean, the amendment didn't have anything that was directed towards minimizing bycatch. It was strictly ACLs and AMs. And you know, we had originally started out Amendment 4 incorporated the monitoring and river herring and all these other items, and then we broke it off. And I think somehow maybe in that, I was wondering if a goal and objective got left behind, and then, you know, we didn't address it in the amendment. And I just raised the issue because I think when we go forward with Amendment 5 in June, if we do, that we all should look at the goals and objectives, because I've read some of the goals and objectives in Amendment 5, and they sound quite nice. They are something you lay out at the very beginning of the process, but quite frankly, we have some goals and objectives in Amendment 5 that we don't address in the amendment. And, you know, if it leaves us open to, interpretation by the court that we haven't met the goals and objectives and therefore subject to suit, I think it's just worth us considering. So that's the only reason I raise it, and I'll raise it again in June.
Dave Gaethel.
Gene, I have two questions. One is, because this was the Herring one, because it was a spec setting, if there's no finding by the time the specifications run out, no definitive conclusion, does this just become moot? Or do you have to reach some kind of conclusion at some point?
I'm not sure if I understood your question. Can you repeat that?
Well, it's a spec setting process. I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 years, but it expires when those specifications expire. So if there's been no definitive finding by the court by the end of the specification process, does it become moot? Kind of like the Framework 42 lawsuit.
Well, it would depend on whether the court vacates Amendment 4. That was one of the things I think the plaintiffs had argued for as a remedy, that the whole amendment be wiped out. And that would be one of the things that we would be briefing to the court in the remedy, that it would probably be better to leave Amendment 4 in place while we address these other issues, because of the very problem that you're alluding to, David. If the Amendment 4 is not vacated in terms, because the court did find that the ACLs and AMs were legal, lawfully justified. So it's very unlikely the court would vacate the entire amendment, given that it had different findings on different issues regarding Amendment 4. So if it's not vacated, then these specifications would not go away necessarily.
Okay, and my second question, and this is just kind of more of an interest thing for me personally, is how long, when can people file friend of the court? People keep getting into these lawsuits, what I would call Johnny-come-latelys. Let's say, for example, I want to join the Amendment 4 Herring lawsuit. Can I just walk in and file a request to become a friend of the court? Is there any end to that process, or can it go on right up until, the judge rules?
It's, as I understand it, and I'm not the world's expert on federal rules of procedure with courts, but it's up to the court to decide whether a friend of the court can file a brief. In this case, it occurred after the other briefs were filed, and we're talking about the Amendment 16 challenge. So it's the court can decide on its own whether it wants another brief to allow another interested or affected party to give their perspective or its perspective on the lawsuit.
Okay, so it's basically on a judge by judge, court by court basis. There's no standard across the court.
I don't think there is a specific standard, but I say that without I can further check. In this particular case, I don't think there was no specific standard cited as a hard and fast procedural rule that either allows or doesn't allow front of the court briefs to be filed, or the timing of when front of the court briefs can be filed. But I, haven't looked at that specifically, but that's my understanding.
Thank you. Anyone else on this? Okay, we will move on to Science Center. Is that Jim or Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start by reviewing some of the surveys. The spring multi-species bottom trawl survey took place from February the 28th to April the 20th on Bigelow. The scallop survey is scheduled for this year from June 1st to July the 7th on the Hugh R. Sharp. The surf clam and ocean quahog survey is scheduled on August the 1st through August the 21st, and that will be on a commercial clam vessel for the first time. The shrimp survey is scheduled from July the 22nd until August the 18th on the Gloria Michelle. And the herring acoustic survey is scheduled from September the 12th through October the 20th on the Pisces. I'd like to make a general announcement about a survey that's going to be taking place soon from the Center's Social Science Branch. And this survey is being implemented. There are actually three surveys that are being implemented, and I'm just making this initial announcement to put it on your radar. And I believe at the next council meeting, someone from our social science branch will be likely here to provide more information about these surveys. But their purpose is to collect the necessary data to better support National Standard 8. National Standard 8 involves the economic and social impacts on communities. So these three surveys, which will take place, will all be voluntary. And the three of them are a survey of commercial fishing vessel crew in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. The second one will be a survey of commercial fishing vessel owners in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. And the third will be an annual cost survey of owners. So, and we will update at the June council meeting on that. Moving on to stock assessments, the December SARC, which was SARC 53, had black sea bass and Gulf of Maine cod, and we spoke about that extensively at your last council meeting. Since then, we have done the groundfish updates in February, and I'll be reporting on that tomorrow morning. The SARC 54 planning for that is in the works for, I believe it's June the 5th through the 9th. It's a Tuesday through a Saturday. And Southern New England yellowtail flounder and herring are on the agenda for benchmark stock assessment reviews. There was a workshop that took place at the end of March dealing with MRFs and MRIP. And also coming up, we have the track in June, late June, which will be in Woods Hole. And the track will be reviewing the assessments of the shared stocks with Canada, Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. The center is also performing assessment updates on numerous mid-Atlantic stocks, and that will be done this spring and summer. And then for the SARC that's upcoming in the fall of next year, SARC 55, currently on the agenda are Atlantic surf clam, Georges Bank cod, and white hake. Although I'm sure many of you are familiar that there's ongoing discussion about whether to add Gulf of Maine cod to that SARC, and if so, how that will affect the list of which species will be included. That concludes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I also welcome Bill Karp to help me out answering in any way that he would like. So, thank you.
Questions? Four.
It's getting a little old calling it a rookie question, but it is. I just wondered if we wanted to actually have an assessment of the health of the sturgeon stock, is that something that would fall under your auspices, or is that someone else that would do that assessment? As I understand it, we haven't seen an assessment since 1998. Thanks.
Right. I don't think that the sturgeon have ever been assessed in the SAW-SARC process. And I go back about 20 years, and I don't recall that assessment being done in our standard peer review process. So I don't know exactly the answer to your question. I know that when it gets into the listing situation and ESA, then other processes take place, and it gets under different jurisdiction. So it's kind of a complicated question, and so I don't have a real clear answer.
Anyone else? Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, the jurisdiction for sturgeon actually falls with Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. But I also understand that this is likely to be a discussion when NRCC meets in May, because clearly it's a issue of mutual concern. Anything else for the Science Center? Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little bit of an update on where we are in general at the Science Center, along the lines of the report that Dan Morris provided to you. As most or perhaps all of you know, I'm also acting. I'm the acting Science Center director, and have been since the beginning of the year. And similarly to the regional administrator, we still have no clear signal as to when the selection process will be completed or who it is that will be selected for that position. So I continue to act and have the privilege of working with the staff at the center. Similarly, also to the regional office, we're struggling with challenges this year and likely more serious challenges in the coming years with regards to resources. So we have staff positions unfilled. We are able to go ahead and fill some vacancies. But we're forced to be rather cautious because of the uncertainty with regards to funding streams in the coming years. So we, of course, continue to be absolutely committed to providing whatever support we can, both to the regional office and to the councils, and we will continue to focus on the priority items that are of great concern. But our ability to expand our capability or to deal with some of the sort of unexpected demands that are placed on us is clearly less than it has been in the past. And while we will continue to work with everybody and accommodate the demands as best we can, we don't have a clear expectation that our resources are going to be augmented in the coming years or even that we'll be able to hold water. So those are a sort of shared concerns across the agency and clearly by the council as well. Thank you.
Jim.
Yeah, I have a question on the Science Center. I've read recently in some of the press things about industry side-by-side surveys. Is that planned for this fall? And, you know, can you fill us in a little bit on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, the issue or questions regarding the possibility and the usefulness of side-by-side surveys, of course, have come up a lot over the years, and most recently in the context of the data streams that support the Gulf of Mankato assessment. We do believe that there are some significant benefits to doing some side-by-side work. And I think most importantly, so that we can develop the capacity to work on an ongoing basis with the industry in the event that the NOAA vessels become unavailable for our standard groundfish surveys. We expect to continue to do all of the standard groundfish surveys with the Bigelow. As you know, the Delaware II is being decommissioned, and so we're losing significant capacity. We're working with the Southeast Fisheries Science Center on a plan to share the capacity that's available in the Pisces, which is very similar to the Bigelow. But just looking ahead, as budgetary issues and potential conflicts over availability of NOAA ships play out, we want to be in a position to be able to maintain the time series. And so what we're looking at is some mechanism for designing side-by-side work which will allow us to switch
to industry vessels to support these survey time series. Our experience in that is that it's very time-consuming and very expensive to do complete intercalibration surveys. And our most recent experience with that, of course, was when we brought the Bigelow online. And so we don't expect that we could embark upon an intercalibration of that scope and complete it in a short period of time. But what we do believe is that we can design that kind of work and begin to work on it in a step-by-step basis as funds become available, so that over time we actually do develop that capacity. The timing, I can't answer that completely because it's going to depend, of course, on availability of funds in the out years. But yes, we are planning to do this, and we are beginning to develop some preliminary plans about how we're going to make that happen.
Last bite at the Science Center, Dave Gaetel.
I wanted to discuss, and I actually, for the agenda for the NRCC, and I was waiting for this particular topic, I would hope that you'd put it on your agenda to find a simpler way forward for setting annual catch limits than what we're currently doing. I think I'm convinced, after having watched this process now, that it's taking too much of the Science Center's time. They can't put the time into the stock assessments they need. And what I would suggest specifically is looking at something around an index, a 3-year running average, and set ACLs based on that. Something that's very simple, formulaic, that we can do without investing huge amounts of staff time, and then let the Science Center go back to doing stock assessments on its regularly scheduled basis, but being able to put the people and the resources into those stock assessments to do what needs to be done. I don't think this process is working right at the moment on either end. I don't think there's enough time allowed to be spent on the stock assessments, and I think we're trying to develop two fancier ways of setting ACLs every year, I think we need to find something simpler. Thank you.
Ito, did you have your hand?
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Vito Calamo, representing the United States Senator Scott Brown. I speak for United States Senator Scott Brown at these meetings. And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kemp, it was 15 years ago that myself and Rodney Avila approached the New England Fisheries Management Council and asked to do cooperative research using fishermen, fishing vessels. And it was kind of shunned upon, talked about a little, but it's music to my ears, and I read it in the local Gloucester Daily Times. It keeps the pulse on the fishing industry, as you know, that it looks like something may be done. While I was on the New England Council, I was asked to go fishing with the Delaware. I believe it was the Delaware at the time, one of the two vessels. And I really thought to have a fisherman that was fishing take my place, and I requested him, and I put Captain Sam Novello, who is probably one of the best personnel from Gloucester, Massachusetts, that is knowledgeable about fishing and twine and gear that I grew up with side by side. So did our fathers and so did our grandfathers. In putting him on the vessel, he came back with a terrible report which started all this trawl problems of the wrong wire, the wrong nets. I just want to tell you, Mr. Kemp, that your research people are probably some of the finest scientists we have, but the people that are running the vessel and doing the gear work are actually fishing for time. Other than when our fishermen go aboard, they're fishing for fish. And they know where the fish are, when they are, what condition they're in, better than anybody in the Northeast region, especially coming out of New Bedford and Gloucester. It's sad to see that the council hasn't listened to us, nor has NIMS listened to people in the industry for a long time. And it's also music to my ears to hear the chairman and my friend Paul Howard say how the fishermen are getting more involved. I won't keep you much longer, but I want to make one more point. When I used to go to the council meeting many years ago, it was made up of the fishing industry. I look around now, and I see a few fishermen. I see some people that say they're fishermen, and some people that may think they're fishing people. And I think you need to listen to the people that are very active fishermen at this point in time and try to get the ship back on course. United States Senator Scott Brown is very heavily involved in the fishing industry, and that's why I came out of retirement to join his team. I'm always been a big supporter of what goes on with the New England Council, and I still am. I hope we continue to go in the right direction. It's very important at this critical time in our fishing industry, whether it's pelagic fish or shrimp fish or ground fish. I think that we need to be all involved in a process that comes out with the correct result. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, again. And as I speak today, I'll make it as quick as possible. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Vito. Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, I'm glad you raised that issue because I wanted to as well. I think there's a growing expectation that within the course of a year, a new cod assessment will be done, and an element of that will be these parallel or side-by-side fishing tows with industry. And I think there's a growing belief in industry, congressional delegations, elected officials, and their spokespeople that a bigger pile of fish on a commercial boat next to the Bigelow is going to have a meaningful impact on a updated or benchmark stock assessment. And it's not. In fact, I'm skeptical, other than what Dr. Cobb talked about, beginning the process of an intercalibration procedure so that in the event of a federal vessel failure or whatever it is, a continuity could be maintained. I just don't see what will come out of one season of paired trawling, but I think there's a great expectation growing that that's going to do something. And if the way I'm characterizing it is correct, I think the Science Center and Regional Off needs to get, and this council needs to get out ahead of that. Otherwise, you're going to likely get the same answer, in my view. And you're going to have public relations debacle bigger than you have now if there's an expectation that a bigger pile of fish on a commercial boat next to the Bigelow is really meaningful in terms of a revised cod stock assessment. Thanks.
Thank you. Burning question on this?
Yeah, just quickly, I would like to agree with Dave Gaethel and just add a couple of things to what he said. What he's asking for is a constant harvest strategy, and I think that, as I've said before, I think it's the right way to go when you have stocks that are at low levels of abundance. We know that the models don't work as well as the abundance levels go down, and Dave mentioned a three-year running average. I think that's appropriate. But we've got to do something, and whether we have a threshold or a point below which in stock abundance below which we move into this constant harvest strategy, three-year running average. To me, it just we can't keep doing the kind of assessment that we're doing and taking the kind of time to split hairs at very low levels of abundance when we know that the repeatability and the reliability of the information is not good when we get below certain points. So I just wanted to support what Dave was saying.
Okay, I would like to continue the report section, move on to the Mid-Atlantic Liaison Report, Frank or Erling or both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid-Atlantic Council met 2 weeks ago in Duck, North Carolina. On the agenda was tilefish, spiny dogfish, squid, mackerel, butterfish, surf clams, ocean quahogs, Atlantic sturgeon. For tilefish, the council voted to approve the annual biological catch limit, and they set the tile at 905 tons. The council agreed to continue with the current regulations of an 8-fish recreational bag and size limit per person and a 500-pound incidental trip limit. They also agreed that there would be no research set aside until there was an updated benchmark assessment. Spiny dogfish, the council voted to approve and set aside a set of alternatives for analysis of Amendment 3. I won't go into any details. We have dogfish on the agenda, I believe, tomorrow. For squid, mackerel, butterfish, the council voted to approve Framework 5. Framework 5 addresses the change in the scope of individuals who would be allowed to conduct vessel hole measurements required under Amendment 11. So, the council also recommended that the AA open the areas known as cultivator shoals on George's Bank as soon as possible for the surf clam and ocean quahog fishery. At the February 2012 meeting, the council requested the AA impose additional conditions on the reopening of any closed area due to PSPs. Atlantic Sturgeon, they had their briefing on that. We're going to have one tomorrow, so I won't go into any details. And that was the, and they also swore in a new council member, Francis Dewey Hemlett of Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And that was basically the crux of the meeting. If Erlen has anything to add.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frank did a good job, so I have nothing to add.
Any questions for Frank? Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, Frank, as you know, the Mid-Atlantic Council has a research set-aside program specific for the auctioning away of fluke, scup, and sea bass. I've been waiting for well over a year for an update on the Mid-Atlantic Council's evaluation of that particular procedure, especially since, again, much of it's being used now for recreational fisheries, causing problems for states, letters of authorization, and the like. So was there an update given regarding the progress of their evaluation of that particular program?
Hang on a second.
Yes, there was. They had an update and went over some advice they'd received from NOAA General Counsel. They had asked, the committee had asked several questions of General Counsel regarding the process, whether it could be done through contracts, for example, rather than grants, whether the council had the authority to run its own auction or to somehow collect money rather than auction fish. The answer that they received prior to this last meeting was no, no, and no. It had to be done through grants, and the council didn't have the authority to run its own auction or to collect money from it. So they had quite a long discussion as to whether they wanted to continue the RSC program at all, and if so, whether they wanted to restrict it only to funding the NEMAP survey. But in the end, they felt that they didn't want to be that restrictive, that there were some ongoing studies for scup and black sea bass, I think in particular, that they wanted to continue. And the net result was they decided to make no change to the program at this time, the RSC program.
So the decision was to make no changes. I assume that means that there would be no Mid-Atlantic Council perspective or view as to whether or not it's appropriate to use the research set aside for auctioning away fluke, scup, and sea bass for recreational fishermen's use. That's status quo. They're not making any changes regarding that.
They did not make any changes regarding that at this time, no.
Surprising. Okay. The report that was provided to the Mid-Atlantic Council from NOAA General Counsel, I think you said, is that available on the Mid-Atlantic Council website, or is it something we need to specifically request as individuals, for example?
I doubt it's on their website, although it might be. It was a letter. It was a letter that Joel McDonald wrote to the council in response to a request from the council to look at several specific issues about that program. You could probably get it from the council office, or we could probably get you a copy from General Counsel's office.
Thank you. Anything else on the MID? Okay, I'm going to go to the Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Nicola sends his regrets. He's ill following his return from the Coast Guard Forum. I'm Lieutenant Commander Ryan Hamill representing him today. For enforcement, since 1 February, we've had 423 boardings of commercial fishing vessels with six significant fisheries violations. Four of those six violations were for state-permitted vessels fishing in the federal EEZ. The observed compliance rate for the period is 98.6. For a safety summary, over the same 423 boardings, 114 violations were issued to 15 individual vessels for a compliance rate of 87.7%. 74 fishermen were assisted by the Coast Guard since 1 January. There's been one death reported during the period. On April 23rd, the fishing vessel Seafoam was discovered underway and unmanned. The master's body was located by a Coast Guard helicopter following a search in the coast of Maine. For 2011, there were five total deaths involving commercial fishing vessels, two of which were fishing related. 31 fishing vessel casualties were reported since the first. 15 were equipment, 14 were other, and two were vessels that were sunk or capsized. There were also 13 terminations during this period. Eight of those were for insufficient survival suits or survival craft issues. That concludes the report. I'm open for questions if there are any.
Any questions? Dave Case?
Thank you, Ryan. On the state vessels in federal waters, were these, do you know how significant the violations were? I mean, in terms of, were these people that were a few hundred yards outside the state line, or were they miles outside it, that type of thing? And in what fisheries were they participating?
Two of the violations were Atlantic sea scallops, and two were northeast multi-species. One was small mesh, one was multi-species. The smallest of those incursions was 1,200 yards, and the largest was 7 miles.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we will move on to VMS, Bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Council members. I'm Bill Semro, the Northeast VMS Program Manager, Office of Law Enforcement in Gloucester. As you know, Mr. Chairman, Special Agent in Charge Logan Gregory can't be here this morning due to a family emergency. Let's see, I've got five quick topics I'd like to brief the Council on. First of all, we're monitoring 1,054 total vessels in the groundfish fishery. That's 388 sector vessels and 128 common pool. First issue is regarding the VMS software changes for Framework 23 in the scallop fishery. The VMS software change was postponed indefinitely last month, and I believe this may be the first time that we were not able to support the implementation of a regulatory change. We had the necessary quotes from the three vendors, expensive as they were. However, there was no contract vehicle in place for one of the vendors. And without a contract, there was no means to pay for the work. Rather than roll out a software change for a portion of the Northeast VMS fleet, I made the decision to postpone the change for the entire fleet. The contract issue is high visibility and priority at headquarters, and I'm confident that it'll eventually get resolved. Until I have more information, I can't say when this software change will move forward. In the meantime, Nero has sent a permit holder letter to the scallop vessel owners with appropriate reporting guidance in lieu of the VMS changes. So that's issue number one. Second issue, and it's related to that, as I mentioned a moment ago, the vendor quotes for Framework 23 were expensive. This is my opinion, given my experience with the past nine or so software changes that I've coordinated in the past 6 years. The total cost was quoted at $38,000, including the necessary programming and software delivery to the vessels. For the few changes requested, primarily to the scallop declaration screen, the rollout hardly seemed very cost-effective to me. I see a part of my job is trying to be a good steward of the taxpayers' money. So, as I've recommended to this council in the past, and I again feel it important to strongly recommend that whenever possible, we bundle software changes for multiple regulatory actions. I know this method is not ideal because of the possible loss of flexibility in making timely changes. And I understand that it would require some careful coordination as we look ahead to proposed actions across fishery plans. In fact, I see that in fish years 2012 and 2013, there are proposals across several plans that call for VMS changes. On the positive side, bundling changes means we get more for our buck, including keeping fixed vendor costs low, and we minimize potential confusion to the industry by sending fewer software updates, each of which have an associated learning curve. Third, concerns a conflict with the VMS type approval and the broader issue of where we want to take the VMS program in the future. You may recall the new VMS reporting requirements were recently announced for the HMS fishery, and then they were subsequently delayed. The VMS requirements for the HMS fishery are coordinated out of the Southeast OLE office. The delay was due in part to a conflict in VMS type approval between the Northeast and the Southeast. In other words, some vessels holding Northeast and Southeast permits would not be able to satisfy the VMS equipment requirements of each region with a single VMS unit. In all other regions except the Northeast, SkyMate vessels are being required to replace their old unit with a new SkyMate unit called an SM250. The SM250 is a closed system which is essentially the satellite communicator, cabling and antennas connected to a Dell laptop with all external ports and drives sealed. The security requirements and OLE's national type approval standards are the primary driver for this change. The SM250, while more tamper-resistant, does not allow for connection to third-party software, as is currently authorized for many Northeast sector vessels to send catch-related data to their managers or the voluntary EVTR, nor does it allow for local software updates. Updating the SM250 software requires that either the owner mail the unit back to the factory, back to the vendor, or the vendor send the update over the air at a very high cost. Under both the Northeast's catch share management scheme and within its cooperative research program, there is momentum to take advantage of the VMS satellite network to transmit increasing amounts of data from third-party software at sea, as well as asking VMS software itself to do more. This direction is counter to the direction being taken with the SM250. So I'm opening a dialogue between Headquarters OLE and the NERO and its Science Center to discuss the SM250 issue and the broader direction of the VMS program and its associated type approval standards. While the HMS issue is driving the need for immediate dialogue, I think that equal consideration must also be given to the path that the Northeast region has undertaken, as well as the direction that other regions may take. Now is the time to engage on these issues to reexamine the VMS operational and security requirements. Fourth, we provided a couple of very useful data products in the past few months using both OLE's VMS and NERO's AMS data. The first report, at the request of Ben Haskell, was an analysis of fixed and mobile gear activity by VMS activity declaration within the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary from 08 through 2011. The Sanctuary Office is using that analysis along with their own analyses using other data sources. Another report was recently provided to NIMS Special Agent Jeff Ray, who's working with Coast Guard Sector New York. We identified fishing hotspots in the New York Bight and surrounding area by VMS activity declaration over a two-year period for the purpose of improving the efficiency and effectiveness of their patrol planning. Both reports lend themselves nicely to expand our analyses into other areas. Finally, our headquarters OLE office was recently notified that vendor Tron and Tron have discontinued the TT3026D model, which is in use in the VMS fleet. While the Northeast operates only about two dozen Tron units, there is a large population in other regions. We've been told that there are sufficient spares available until a newer model, the 3027, is submitted in the future, in the very near future, to OLE for type approval. And that completes my report, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take any questions.
David Pierce.
You mentioned that a report was prepared for the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary regarding fishing activity in the sanctuary, as judged from VMS information. Is that report available to the council?
Well, it certainly would be, since the council has access to the VMS data.
Right. So I would request that report be made available to the council, since it's very relevant to our discussions about the sanctuary, certainly habitat discussions, SARA, that I believe is going to be discussed by us. So I would make that request of you, Mr. Chairman, that that report be provided to the council.
Is there any objection on the council? Okay, we'll put that on the list to officially request it. Anyone else? Dave Gaethel and Mary Beth.
Bill, thank you for highlighting some of these issues with the software situation, and especially taking the lead on this SkyMate thing. It does seem counterintuitive to have to remove a unit and send it back to change something. I assume that means the entire time it's off the boat can't leave the dock. You know, should this occur, at least for some of us that are, you know, only have certain seasons and whatnot, it could be literally catastrophic. So I guess I'm a little bit confused as to why they need to make it, why they have to have their own computer with all the data ports sealed and everything. What exactly is wrong with the system we have now? Is there evidence somebody's tampering with it, or somehow programming the computer to do something malicious? Or, you know, could you provide a little more information on that?
Sure, Dave. With the SkyMate unit, the owner provides their own PC to run the SkyMate software, and it connects to the satellite communicator. I'm not aware of any, GPS spoofing of, you know, VMS signals with the VMS, headquarters OLE has stated that there have been evidence of tampering overseas. And simply by that evidence of tampering, out there within industry, there's a strong desire to close down those units, and also to make them less vulnerable to viruses.
Okay, well, that's interesting. The other statement I would make is the issue of the costs here. I'm glad somebody's looking out for the poor taxpayer here once in a while. I appreciate it. But is this an issue of the fact that these are basically sole source contracts, or there's not much competition in the VMS marketplace? So is that the issue, or is it an issue that's more related to these companies are trying to find ways to increase their revenue streams off the backs of us?
You know, Dave, I really can't say. I don't know exactly. I just, in the past, I really hadn't been privy to the cost of software changes. Those quotes were handled, separately from the actions and, you know, the work that I do. More recently, within the last couple of years, you know, I've been more engaged on that process. And, you know, again, I'll give you an example where the cost, there are fixed costs in sending the software out to the fishermen, you know, and I think the idea of providing, bundling changes, we're going to pay the fixed cost no matter what. You're going to pay them every time you do a software change. So the more changes that we can bundle together, we're gonna save a little bit of money in the long run. Obviously, we've got only three approved vendors right now. We've got two that are in the wings, Faria and CLS America. But you're going to them for software changes. They're the ones that are that are actually doing the programming and sending it out. And it really depends, I suppose, on how our headquarters defines for the vendors how they submit their quotes. You know, whether it's, you know, time and, you know, labor, whatever the reasons that they, you know, the vehicles that they use to submit their quotes, I really don't have any, you know, very much input into that.
Okay, one last question, because you might not be here tomorrow when it comes up may come up under groundfish. If, for example, the industry wanted to buy a software change, are they allowed to do that, or can only the government buy a software change?
Very interesting. I wouldn't think I'd have the industry asking to buy the change. Just to get the updates on their vessel. That's a good question. Again, I'd have to defer that to headquarters. I don't know. Okay. Be happy to look into it if you want.
Yeah, it might be useful, because I think there may be a case arriving where the industry may request a VMS software change for groundfish. And, you know, they're currently under the belief that this could be done, you know, in these bundling packages, you know, maybe 90 days out there or something. And if, in fact, that is not the case at the moment, and it might sit for a year as an example, they may want to consider whether or not they can, you know, charge, say, sector members as an example for a software upgrade. So if an answer could be provided to that question, it might be helpful to the industry. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, one thing we do make a point of doing is ensuring that everybody is on the same software. You know, you're going to start losing our ability to maintain compliance when you've got people on various software versions. So, but I'll look into that and let you know.
Got Mary Beth and Glenn, then we're going to go take a break. I was hoping to get reports done, but no, then we're going to finish up with ASMFC and NROC after our break.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, Bill. I was listening to a discussion at the North Pacific about HAPCs and boundaries and enforcement issues around the size of areas and that sort of thing, and there was a reference to geofencing. And I thought, oh, this sounds really interesting to me, because our habitat discussions and the size of these areas, whether they be closures to some or not, are hugely, you know, impacts to a lot of different sectors. And I thought, well, here's something new. And as the discussion went along, the description of what geofencing was, that's what they do in the Northeast. That was a surprise to me. I hadn't heard us use this description before. It does refer to VMS, and I'm just curious if that's a term that you are familiar with and
sure.
Maybe could describe to us. I mean, the impression I got was it allows, you know, could allow us to use more discrete closures or boundary lines as we define some of these areas in the region.
Yeah, within our VTRAC monitoring system, every vessel position that's collected is associated with areas that are programmed within the system. We've got, you know, over 125 areas that are, northeast areas that are programmed into VTRAC. So any position on the chart is associated with those areas that it falls within. And that data is collected. It's historical. It can be pulled and used in analyses, some of those analyses I mentioned earlier for the Coast Guard or the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary are done using geo-referencing or geo-fencing. And of course, it has application in terms of, closed area boundaries and alerting of positions referenced to closed areas or access areas. Does that help to answer, or are you looking for something more specific?
Just one very quick follow-up.
Sure.
From the discussion that they were having, it seemed to be from their VMS personnel in the region, something that could justify having more discrete areas because you can identify positioning of vessels. And I'm not sure we've had that same discussion here. And I was just hearing them reference the program we have here as being one that allows you to do that. Just would you agree with that we have the ability to with vessel positioning, to be more discrete in closed areas and or not just closed areas. It's really not a closed area issue. It's a boundary issue. It could be the difference between using a certain gear type, you know, inside, outside. There's a whole bunch of different things there. But our ability, our number of vessels that we cover now, it does seem that we can be more discreet in our management actions. And I don't really want to put you on the spot, but I guess I kind of was there.
Well, I'll try to keep it brief. Obviously, there are certain limits to what we can and can't do with VMS. I mean, we're counting on the, you know, for example, the declaration that is sent by the vessel prior to sailing that says, you know, here's where I'm going to fish and this is the gear I'm going to use. And then, of course, that's referenced to the areas, you know, when we do our monitoring, the areas that they're fishing within. So, you know, I think there are areas where you can be more discreet, and we haven't been. I mean, for example, in the herring, you know, herring declaration, I mean, all we know is they're out there, you know, herring fishing. Be nice, for example, and I think there's a move afoot, if this is the direction you're looking, where in the upcoming amendment, maybe putting a gear declaration within, you know, within the activity declaration, so because that's going to give us more information to help us do our jobs, and I think also to collect data for management decisions. Is that where you're going, or close enough? Okay, all right.
Glenn?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Bill, there was a presentation at the Fisherman's Forum. The state of Maine's been looking into it's a cell phone-based technology, uses cell phone towers, and it sounded to me like it was basically a data logger system. Whenever it was in range, it would transmit a packet that would go through email, but when you were out of range, it was off, you know, offshore, it would just save the data and then transmit it later. You wouldn't have real-time contact with the vessel, but it sounded like it was much more affordable and may be able to do the job. Have you considered something like that?
I'm not familiar exactly with what you're talking about, Glenn. I do know that, for example, the vendor Faria, right up the road here in Uncasville, it uses that dual technology where when it's within range, it uses cell phone to transmit the VMS data, and obviously when it's out of range, it uses satellite. So there's a cost savings there. But yours sounds a little different where when it's out of range, it just stores the data. I don't see that working because of the near real-time monitoring that we do.
Yeah, it looked like, I may be wrong, but it looked like there was no satellite connection. But it would leave a trail of where you have been. So if anybody was to look at it after you returned to port, and you were somewhere you weren't supposed to be, seems like you would get caught. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand. One quick comment there. You know, one of the things we do as a team is work with the Coast Guard. And so if we, you know, if we want to do any kind of, obviously, real-time enforcement at sea and provide VMS data, then we've got to have that data then right then and there, rather than wait for it and look at it in a historical sense.
Thank you, Bill.
Yep, you're welcome.
Thank you, Bill. We will take a 10-minute break back at 11:10. They will trickle back in. Dr. Pierce, do you have any report from the ASMFC for us?
Sure. Okay. I'm playing to an empty house, but that's okay. The portion of the sea herring section that needs to deal with decisions about days for landing sea herring in the New England states, notably Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, met last week with advisors present, members of the industry present, and we talked about what days out strategy should we have for this year, beginning June 1st. And we did come up with an approach that was very similar to the one we used last year. So the section, sea herring section, this component of it, continues to be very supportive of the New England Council's efforts to deal with how to prolong the quotas that we have in Area 1A, specifically the inshore portion of the Gulf of Maine. It's a good partnership that we have with this council, since if this council did not have the cooperation of the three states, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, I suspect the council would be burdened with the very difficult task of trying to determine how to make a very small quota last as long as possible. So we continue to do that work in cooperation with the fishing industry. The ASMFC meeting is scheduled for next week, and there will be a very heavy emphasis on pelagic species. The Menhaden Board is meeting. The sea herring, the Atlantic sea herring section meeting is formally taking place next week. I do chair that section. And then we have the River Herring and Shad Management Board as well. At the sea herring section meeting, which occurs on Monday, I will be, for the benefit of the section, reviewing the public hearing comments that were provided on this council's amendment, our catch monitoring amendment, because the section may want to offer up some comments regarding what the council intends to do with this amendment at our June meeting. So we'll see what the section decides to do relative to friendly advice. Laura asked a question a little while ago about Atlantic sturgeon and assessments of Atlantic sturgeon. The ASMFC is having a meeting of its sturgeon board. As indicated, the sturgeon is managed by the states. And our meeting will involve quite a bit of discussion regarding what to do with the endangered species listing for sturgeon in south of the Cape, Cape Cod, and, of course, the threatened status for sturgeon, Mass Bay, Gulf of Maine. We will be receiving a committee report, a technical committee report. The technical committee report, I suspect, will deal with an update as to where we stand right now with the status of the sturgeon resource. As indicated earlier on, the last assessment that was done, a peer-reviewed assessment for sturgeon, was back, I think, in 1998. It was a long time ago. The states thought that we had sturgeon under control simply by having, no possession. But obviously that has not worked, at least in the eyes of the National Marine Fisheries Service. Well, NOAA fisheries. So we'll be discussing that, what to do relative to a response strategy that the states are going to have to develop to deal with these listings, since it has tremendous implications for how the states manage our fisheries, and, of course, it has tremendous implications for how we go forward, how this council goes forward with management of sturgeon in response to these listings. So I won't get into the specifics regarding river herring and shad, except to say that the river herring board also will be taking a look at the council's catch monitoring amendment for sea herring, and that board also may offer up a perspective as to preferred alternatives that it would like to see adopted by the council. Now I'll just add one other thing and turn to any other state members of ASMFC regarding their views of anything that this council needs to be made aware of. Spiny dogfish, the service indicated, George indicated earlier this morning that indeed the service did adopt the quota that both councils wanted, and that was the 35 point some odd million pounds. The ASMFC still stands at 30 million pounds. I made a motion at the last ASMFC Spiny Dogfish Board to reconsider our previous decision about the 30 million pounds and to go with the New England Council and Mid-Atlantic Council numbers, the higher numbers, especially since now we know that the service has adopted that higher amount. I think I was soundly defeated in my motion. The ASMFC states did not want to reconsider, that is, going to the higher number. So it appears that even though the federal permit holders will have a higher quota than ASMFC, the federal permit holders will be ruled by ASMFC landing limits and by the quota that we have established, the lower amount. It remains to be seen whether or not, once again, the board meeting next week will reconsider and move towards the higher amount. That's sort of a wait and see. I'm not sure what will happen in that regard. Those, I believe, are the board meetings and the species that would be of interest to this council. So if any other states care to add, please do so.
Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Dave and maybe Gene, I'm a little bit concerned about you mentioning that the federal quota is X, but state regulations will not allow that X to be landed. So, Gene, that appears to me that that's inconsistent with the federal plan. So I think it behooves the council to do something, to weigh in on this. We don't want to be held hostage by the states when the federal government agrees on a certain harvest level.
Yeah, I mean, I just came in. Which fish are we talking about?
Dogfish.
We'll have to. Let's look at it. I've got to take a look exactly what we need to do here. I think Mid-Atlantic has the lead. I need to talk to Joel McDonald, who's sort of the lead legal counsel on this, to see if he's looked into this or made any advice on it.
Seems to me David's solution to have the ASMSC change their quota seems the easiest way out.
Yeah, it may be true.
Tom. In the interest of pursuing that, would a letter from the council be helpful there? If that was the thought, then and the chair wanted to entertain that, I'd certainly make that in the form of a motion.
That's fine.
And I'd move that the council draft a letter, send a letter to the ASMFC recommending that they adopt the federal quota, federal dogfish quota for, I think it's 2013 only, to avoid misalignment between federal and state waters plans.
Is there a second to that? Mark Gibson. George.
Just a reminder to everybody, that's still proposed. They're not in place yet. So.
Sorry, Karen, it's actually 2012. Apologies.
Discussion. Dave Gaetham.
I think procedurally it might be more correct to say that they reconsider adoption of the federal dogfish quota. I mean, that's what you're asking them to do, is to reconsider a vote that's already been taken. So I suggest that as a way to make this more procedurally correct.
Do you take that as a friendly seconder? Okay. I think it's the federal dogfish. Discussion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Dave Gaetham.
I think there could be some elements to the letter, too, that, for example, if they don't reconsider, that they allow a transiting provision from federal waters through state waters to land them, something like that, and provide some alternatives in the event that they don't want to actually reconsider the number.
Paul.
I would say if they don't reconsider, it's inconsistent with the federal plan, and there are rules in Magnuson for for what to do if it's inconsistent with the federal plan. That's the higher bar to go over.
Okay, that's fine.
Mark.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Is it the intent that this letter will be in the commission's hands by next meeting?
What's
the because, and the reason I ask, because there are, this is a fairly heavy lift for us down there. I believe there are some nuances in Robert's Rules of Order about two-thirds majority requirements and if there is not notice, prior notice given to the request for the action. So Dave and I may want to study those and make sure that the agenda is appropriately structured for that day. I'm assuming that this council, if this motion passes, would get the letter out fairly quickly.
Paul says he can get it out by Friday. David.
Yeah, it's the issue is already on the agenda. I assume that next week I might have the opportunity to once again make a motion to reconsider, and hoping that I would get the two-thirds vote. So this particular motion by the council will be very helpful in moving this forward. And, of course, if Gene, in his further consultation with his colleagues, concludes that there is some legal reason why SMFC should reconsider, then that will definitely grease the skids.
Thank you. Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor so indicate. Fourteen in favor. Opposed? Abstentions? 1-14-01. The motion carries. Anything else on ASMFC? Okay, well, I'm going to ask John Weber to come up and give us a report on NROC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be very fast, mostly because most of you spent quite a bit of time with me very recently hearing me do a lot of talking. So a couple of quick updates for you. My name is John Weber. I'm the Ocean Planning Director for the Northeast Regional Ocean Council. First and of all, thank you to those of you who were with us at Roger Williams University approximately a month ago. From our perspective, that event absolutely met our goals, and we very much appreciate all of your time and, most importantly, your thought and criticism and critical thinking about moving forward with ocean planning here in New England. A couple of quick notes on that. There is a workshop summary that is just about final that will be sent out to all attendees and be available on our website, et cetera, et cetera. We've also had, and that will happen in about a week, we have also had a couple of requests for some of the presentations that were made at that workshop. Those presentations will be attached to that workshop summary as an appendix, but if there is interest in the meantime or you don't see what you are looking for, please certainly get a hold of me and I'd be happy to provide you with copies of those. One thing moving forward then that we clearly heard at that workshop was the need for us as we are moving out on this work to communicate, to be engaged, to be out and about throughout the region. We have heard that loud and clear. And so thanks to a couple of folks who I have had the opportunity to follow up with to develop specific meetings and opportunities in the next little while to come and chat with you and your communities and your constituencies. I think that's ultimately the best way that we're going to move forward on this is face-to-face type conversations. But we are also actively working on several other vehicles for communications going forward, things like a newsletter, things like a listserv, things like much-needed updates to our websites and others. So please stay tuned and have a little bit of patience with us as we gear up for this work very immediately. Two other fast updates for you. You heard earlier this morning an update from the chair regarding the Fishery Management Council representative on this regional planning body, Doug Grout, moving forward. The states also have put forward their nominations for people to serve on the regional planning body. They had a deadline of last Friday to do so. Let me know if any questions. I don't actually know all the members who were put forward, but I do know some. So let me know if any questions on that. The last thing that I will say is an update on our commercial fishing mapping characterization work, which you've heard me talk about before. We are entering into a contract with a team of folks led by folks from the University of Rhode Island Coastal Resources Center and including the Maine Island Institute and including George LaPointe to help us with some of that work. That means that work will start in earnest very, very soon in the next couple of weeks. This, again, is our intent is to use existing data, such as the VTR, VMS data that we've been talking about this morning and others, hopefully, to start doing some mapping work. Also, thank you to those such as David and Paul who have agreed to help us and serve in an advisory role for that work. If there is other interest in serving such a role, please let me know. Get in touch with me by email or I'll be around today. So I promise that would be very short and happy to answer any questions at this time.
I have one quick one. It may not be a fair question to ask at this point in time because it's early, but what is the implication if the House committee that's considering not funding or defunding the National Ocean Policy presidential order? What impact does that have on NROC?
The funding that we have in hand for our first two-year work plan that you've heard me talk about before is in the bank, so to speak. So our intent is to move forward with those elements of the work plan now. So the projects that I was just speaking of and other things that you heard us talk about at Roger Williams. I think that in terms of future funding for future work, because I think we all clearly recognize that what we're talking about is going to take more than 2 years done right. That is a very good question. And depending on what is the outcome of the ongoing budget discussions, both in the House and the Senate side, and however that meets forward, that's absolutely something that we're going to have to pay attention to going forward. Does that mean then that the regional planning body that we've been talking about would not meet and start actual work on this? That honestly remains to be seen. I do think that, as I said, our intent would still be to do some of the work that we're planning on doing just because we think those are good standalone products anyway.
Anyone else? Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, recognizing that fisheries is longstanding and one of the most important activities in the region, we're very appreciative that the council has a seat, but each state will have two seats. Can you tell us if the states have provided their director of fisheries as filling one of those seats to cover state and fisheries interests?
Yeah, here's the latest as I understand it. The state of Maine, yes. Pat Kelleher has been put forward by Governor LePage, as well as the commissioner of the Department of Conservation, Bill Beardsley. New Hampshire, I believe it is the commissioners of their Department of Environmental Services and Fish and Game, so that would be Doug's boss. Massachusetts, I believe it is Paul Diodati and Bruce Carlisle, who is the director of the CZM office there. Those are the ones that I know. I honestly do not know the status of the Rhode Island or Connecticut nominations.
Anyone else on the council? Sally.
Yeah, thanks. John, can you just talk a little bit about your plans for outreach to the fishing industry and fishing communities, and if you're going to be doing that outreach in conjunction to existing meetings so that people have an easier opportunity to participate?
Short answer is yes, absolutely, to the latter point. I think clearly we heard the message, and we knew this, that yes, if for this to be successful, engagement and often and starting now, as we're just gearing up, has to happen, but that we don't need to come up with a whole plethora of new meetings for that to happen. So I've already started working with some folks in some of the states as to what are those existing opportunities starting now, actually coming up fairly soon in Portsmouth. We'll be doing a fisheries roundtable as an example. I was at the Maine Fisheries Forum, et cetera, et cetera. So wherever possible, yes, absolutely, we are going to do that. That said, I also expect that there will be some occasions where we will have to, and we are happy to do this, to have a special conversation, special set-aside meeting as this gears forward. One of the things that most attracted us to the team that I mentioned that we're bringing on board to help us with this is that is their existing relationships with the industry throughout New England. And so that was a big thing that we were looking for in order for us to enhance our ability to reach out to the industry.
Sherry?
Thank you, Chairman. John, I just want to clarify for everybody that the New Hampshire DES is not Doug's boss. they are the program that is involved with you is the coastal program through DES, and Steve Kuchar is the individual that will be involved with NROC through that program. And we, as Fish and Game, have been involved since DES has started working with NROC.
If I could, just to clarify, what I was speaking to is the state of New Hampshire's membership on the regional planning body. So you're absolutely right. Steve is a member of NROC, but it's my understanding that the DES and Fish and Game commissioners have been nominated to be part of that regional planning body. So thank you for that.
Anyone else? Thank you, John. Okay. Do you have a question for John? Why don't you just come up to the microphone?
Tina Jackson, American Alliance of Fishermen. I'm sorry, what was your name again, Tom?
Doug. John Weber.
John, excuse me. I apologize. you said 2 years' worth of funding was in the bank. How much was that?
The total is approximately $2.5 million.
And was that taxpayer funded?
There is approximately $1.3 million of that is federal dollars.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I had a question for.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
That ends the reports section of the agenda, and we'll move into the review of the experimental fishery permits.